thanks for coming in on a rainy night. We're really pleased to have you here. All the programs are presented by and underwritten by the Friends of North Castle Public Library. But tonight we have Westchester Community College Professor Richard Courage, who's going to talk about his book, The Muse of Bronzeville, about the American Renaissance in the African American community in Chicago. And without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Professor Courage.
Thank you, Fran. It's a pleasure to be here. And what I'm going to do today is tell you a bit about the rather large story that my book, The Muse in Bronzeville, African American Creative Expression in Chicago, 1932 to 1950, tells a rather large story. I'll give you a sampling of it tonight. Let me, first of all, introduce you to my co-author. This gentleman is Robert A. Bone. He was my teacher at Columbia University Teachers College through the 1980s. And the seed idea for this book was an essay that he published in 1986 called Richard Wright and the Chicago Renaissance. Now, Bone passed away late in 2007. And I spent the better part of the next 4 years completing an unfinished book, taking it in some new directions and fleshing out some of the trails, directions that he had begun. Let me take you right to a passage from the preface. This is the, let's call it the Bone Courage thesis. Focusing on such figures as Richard Wright, Arna Bontemps, Gwendolyn Brooks, Margaret Walker, and Horace Caton Jr., Robert Bone argued that Chicago's South Side experienced a period of creative ferment during the 1930s and 1940s, comparable in achievement and scope to the Harlem Renaissance, that it became for some 15 years the center of African-American writing, and that Richard Wright was the towering figure of his generation of black literary artists. Now, this is a fairly large claim. I assume that we're all familiar with the Harlem Renaissance and some of the leading lights. Some of the names in my list may be familiar, some may not. Our argument is that just as Uptown New York was the center for flowering in the 1920s, Southside Chicago was the center for a similar and different flowering, but of equal power in the Depression years, the 1930s, the World War II years. So let me start by describing the physical terrain on which this Renaissance took place. Renaissance meaning creative flowering of the arts. Now the title, The Muse in Bronzeville, I'm sure you're familiar with the Muses, the nine sisters who inspired artists, poets, writers, dramatists, but Bronzeville may be a less familiar term. So I'm going to read you just a little bit from the introduction that lays out what Bronzeville is all about and what the physical terrain of the South Side looked like in the late 30s, early 40s. In 1945, social scientists Sinclair Drake and Horace Caton described the South Side of Chicago as a community of stark contrasts. At once an impoverished ghetto, densely populated, dirty, disease, and crime-ridden. And let me show you some images of this ghetto. The South Side in the late 30s and 40s, the Depression year, was a community with garbage-strewn back alleys. It was a community with a largely dilapidated housing stock, teetering tenement buildings like this one. But that was not the entire picture. in the social human landscape. It was also a mighty black metropolis, a city within a city, boasting its own cultural and economic institutions, its own business, professional, and political leadership, and its own intellectual and artistic elite. A few more photos. These were all taken in 1940-41. These two were homes on the south side of Chicago in 1941, neat little cottages. This is the apartment that belonged to Sinclair Drake, one of the authors of Black Metropolis. He was then a graduate student in social anthropology at the University of Chicago. This is the Palm Tavern, an elegant watering hole frequented by the likes of Cab Calloway and Duke Ellington when they were in town. Drinking usually with Earl Hines. This is St. Thomas Episcopal Church, one of the more fashionable middle-class congregations on the south side. This is a ball, a society ball. The organization was called the Royal Society of Snakes. So, snakes, yes. There's a funny story. I've met a gentleman in his 90s who belonged to the Royal Society of Snakes. They were founded to compete with a group that was called the Society of Frogs, because snakes eat frogs. I learned that when I give my talks in Chicago, I learned the things I couldn't find in the archives. So try to keep the entire spectrum in mind. Chicago, black Chicago, was overwhelmingly a poor community, but the entire social spectrum was represented. Now I'm going to jump back, a sort of flashback, very quickly, to talk a little bit about the Harlem Renaissance. We're going back from the 30s and 40s to the 1920s, uptown Manhattan. I just want to make some points about the Harlem Renaissance by way of contrast with what happened in Chicago. This is a fairly famous rooftop photo. The shot was taken in 1924, November 1924, 580 St. Nicholas Avenue, which was a particularly tony address because it's on a bluff that overlooks much of Manhattan. These distinguished-looking gentlemen, I'll just give you the quick cast of characters. These are some of the luminaries-to-be of the Harlem Renaissance. On the left is a very young Langston Hughes. He's, I believe, 1 year away from graduation from Lincoln University, an historically black institution in Pennsylvania. To Hughes's right, Charles S. Johnson, an eminent sociologist and editor of Opportunity magazine, which published people like Langston Hughes, Arnold Bontemps, Zora Neale Hurston, got these young artists published for the first time. In the middle is E. Franklin Frazier, another sociologist who became the chair of the department at Howard University. To his right, Rudolf Fischer, whose day job was as a doctor of radiology, and in his spare time, he wrote some of the finest novels of the Harlem Renaissance, like The Conjure Man. And on the far right, a gentleman named Hubert Delaney, who went on to a distinguished career in law and as a family court judge. He was actually the younger brother of the Delaney sisters, Bessie and Sarah. If you remember a book called Having Our Say, that was the kid brother. My point is, within black society, the people who made the Harlem Renaissance, the intellectuals and writers and visual artists, were a relatively elite group. They didn't always have high incomes, but they came from what W.E.B. Du Bois called the talented tenth. They were well-educated and relatively privileged. Now, they chose, however, at least the best of the writers, to not so much write about the upper stratum of black life, but to write about the ordinary, what in the 60s would be called the brother on the block, whether the southern farmers, or northern industrial workers, or musicians, ne'er-do-wells, prostitutes, a whole range of lower class folks, but in a particularly celebratory mode. This was one of the keys to the Harlem Renaissance, is that these very well-educated folks were writing about ordinary, more or less ordinary black folk, and finding things to celebrate, particularly in such expressions of black life as music, jazz and blues, and sometimes spirituals. I'm going to play I'm playing Langston Hughes reading one of his more famous poems, The Weary Blues. And I'm going to give you that as a sort of a representation of a whole range of Harlem Renaissance writing. And let me play it for you, and then I'll just make a few brief comments. This is Hughes reading it. You'll see some slides of artwork that are actually contemporary with us by a fellow named Maurice Evans, and one or two images that were rendered by Aaron Douglas, the premier visual artist of the Harlem Renaissance. So you'll know Douglas's work. It has this kind of art deco geometric look to it. Let me play the poem for you.
Droning a drowsy syncopated tune, rocking back and forth to a mellow croon, I heard a Negro play. Down on Lenox Avenue the other night, by the pale dull pallor of an old gas light, he did a lazy sway. He did a lazy sway to the tune of those weary blues. With his ebony hands on each ivory key, he made that poor piano moan with melody. Oh, blues. Swaying to and fro on his rickety stool, he played that sad, raggy tune like a musical fool. Sweet blues, coming from a black man's soul. Oh, blues. In a deep song voice with a melancholy tone, I heard that Negro sing, that old piano moan. Ain't got nobody in all this world. Ain't got nobody but myself. I was going to quit my frowning and put my troubles on the shelf. Thump, thump, thump went his foot on the floor. He played a few chords, then he sang some more. I got the weary blues and I can't be satisfied. Got the weary blues and can't be satisfied. I ain't happy no more, and I wish that I had died. Far into the night he crooned that tune. The stars went out, and so did the moon. The singer stopped playing and went to bed, while the weary blues echoed through his head. He slept like a rock, or a man that's dead.
As Gwina quit my frowning and put my troubles on the shelf. Now, I hope no one thinks that Langston Hughes actually talked like that in his ordinary life. That was a fellow with a bachelor's degree from a good university. He's imitating the speech of southern-born ordinary black folk, or in this case, a rather talented musician playing in some kind of joint on Lenox Avenue. There are two points here. One is the celebration of music. The poem itself is musical from start to finish. It's about a blues musician. It uses musical devices like what English teachers call onomatopoeia, that thump, 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 where the words capture the music. And Hughes's reading of the poem is extraordinarily musical. It's kind of like today's spoken art, spoken word art. So it's a celebratory literature. And it's a literature produced by rather well-educated elite figures writing about ordinary folks without the kinds of privileges and educations that they had. Now, the Chicago Renaissance was different. The gap between the artists and the people they represented was relatively narrower. Some of the artists of Chicago had as their parents sharecroppers, slaughterhouse factory workers, domestics. And the art was not particularly racially celebratory, it was racially indignant. And that's what I want to go into for a few minutes now. I want to take you on a little journey from Harlem to Bronzeville, from the 1920s to the mid-1930s. And I want to talk about some of the people who made the Black Chicago Renaissance, the colleagues and comrades, the friendships that made this creative ferment happen. Let me start by going back to Langston Hughes for a moment and his best friend, Arnaud Bontemps. Now, everyone's heard of Langston Hughes. Not many people have heard of Arnaud Bontemps. They were best friends, they were close colleagues for 40 years, from the mid-20s when they met until Hughes died in the mid-60s. Each of them produced as editor or author some 36 books. They were extraordinarily prolific. Bontemps, if you want to explore him, look for his novels. God Sent Sunday, Black Thunder, Drums at Dusk. They're all still in print. Bontemps moved to Chicago in 1935, lived there for 8 years. His friend Langston Hughes visited constantly. So these two gentlemen, who had made their mark initially in the Harlem Renaissance, became, we might say, father figures, mentors to the rising young artists who grew up in Chicago. And if you compared, as I have, the writing that Bontemps and Hughes did in the 30s with their work of the 20s, it's very different. It is the Depression. People's lives are destroyed. People who had a little bit in the 20s, whether they were working class whites or blacks, they lost it in the Depression. They were unemployed. They were on the brink of starvation. They were thrown out of their homes. The art produced had a radical, angry edge to it. And you can see this in most of the work of the Chicago Renaissance. Now, I'll move to two figures. The one on the left is Gwendolyn Brooks, the poet. And on her right, her best friend, Margaret Burroughs. Now, Brooks, you've probably heard of. She was the first African-American writer to win the Pulitzer Prize in 1950. She won it for her second poetry collection, which was called Annie Allen. In 1945, she published her first collection called A Street in Bronzeville. That word Bronzeville had a certain ring to it. I want to just jump back a moment to the introduction to tell you where Bronzeville comes from. Most residents called this area the South Side, but the name Bronzeville, coined by one of its 5 weekly newspapers in the early 1930s, had become increasingly popular. If the term South Side was a neutral geographic description, and if the designation Black Belt conjured images of Southern segregation moved to the North, then the other name, Bronzeville, was the name most closely associated with racial achievement on various fronts and with community pride and self-definition. So when Gwendolyn Brooks called her first book A Street in Bronzeville, she too was celebrating the lives of the people who lived around her. But she herself was very much part of that community. Her father, David, worked as a porter in a publishing firm, a music publishing firm, for his whole career, although he had once had dreams of becoming a doctor. Brooks was the preeminent black poet of her age. Her friend Margaret Burroughs, although I suspect you may not have heard of her, was something of a queen mother on the South Side of Chicago. Burroughs died a couple of years ago in her early 90s. Brooks passed about 6 years ago. They took very different paths. Gwendolyn Brooks was the poet par excellence. She dedicated herself to continually honing her craft, learning everything she could about the art of poetry. Each book she published, A Street in Bronzeville, Annie Allen, In the Mecca, The Bean Eaters, every collection became more and more intrinsically shaped, finely polished. She was the poet dedicated to craft. Margaret Burroughs, by contrast, chose a path of political activism and community service. She was an institution builder. She founded the first African-American history museum in the United States, called the DuSable Museum, and also a very important institution called the Southside Community Arts Center, built with WPA money, the Federal Art Project, in 1940. I find in their friendship, which endured for 40 years, they met in high school, actually it was more than 40 years, their enduring friendship survived the choices that they made. And a lot of the artists in this radical time had to face similar choices. Would they be primarily artists or would they be primarily activists? Now, I'll read you just a little bit about the two of them. And about the place where, here's a writing group that they both participated in the early 1940s at the Community Arts Center. This is one of the places where I think they made those essential life choices. Gwendolyn Brooks, as she was publishing her poems in a newspaper called the Chicago Defender, she sent them to a very eminent black poet named James Weldon Johnson, who wrote back and said, "You have talent. What you need to do is learn the best of modern poetry. Learn where the cutting edge is so that you can surpass it." Back to the book. Brooks deepened her engagement with the moderns in a Wednesday evening poetry workshop at the Southside Community Arts Center. Its founder, Inez Cunningham Stark, you can see her leaning over on the left, was a white socialite who wrote about art for Chicago newspapers, served as a reader for Poetry Magazine, and helped advance the city's cultural avant-garde. With a list provided by the local NAACP, she gathered a group of Southside residents interested in writing. Gwendolyn Brooks vividly recalled Stark, quote, "tripping into meetings, slender, erect, frosted with a fabulous John Frederick's hat, her arms loaded with books." Typically, Stark announced the evening's topic and read a group of poems to illustrate. Brooks continues, "when she had finished, a burst of excitement met her full blast. The students evaluated, criticized, praised, tore. They treated similarly their own precious creations, laboriously evolved during the 7 days since the last meeting. Sometimes what we said to each other hurt or stung. We were all desperately earnest." Stark prodded these young writers to find language that would startle the reader, to explore the elasticity of poetic form, to find subjects in the things and people they knew. She used a poetic handbook that cautioned, quote, "from the technical standpoint, no poem is stronger than its weakest word." I found I'll read from it, it's in the book. I found a letter in Robert Bone's files from Margaret Burroughs that dated it from 1981. And this is part of that letter, talking about this poetry group. Margaret Burroughs, the activist, wrote, "we read our works and there was a critique. Some of the class criticized my work as being too political, propagandistic. I wrote about the Scottsboro Boys and other social themes. I decided to leave the poetry to Gwen and started writing for children." That was the point at which their paths, at least artistically, diverged. Scottsboro, you may be familiar with, was the case of nine black youths in Alabama who were falsely accused of rape. And basically on death row for the better part of the 1930s. It was the cause célèbre of the 30s. So while Margaret Burroughs took these social themes as her subject matter, Brooks was more concerned with fashioning the language that would itself become the art. Margaret Burroughs left the poetry to Gwen and wrote actually a wonderful children's book called Jasper the Drumming Boy, about a kind of hyperkinetic kid who's always moving, always drumming. And she cut new ground largely as an educator, a community activist, and a teacher. While her friend Gwendolyn Brooks went on to win the Pulitzer Prize. Let me tell you about another pair here. This is the last set of colleagues and comrades who made the Black Chicago Renaissance. On the left, the sociologist Horace Caton. On the right, the novelist, fiction and nonfiction writer Richard Wright, the towering figure of his generation of literary artists. Let me read you a little bit. This is from a pivotal chapter called Bronzeville and the Documentary Spirit. One thing that fascinated me about these men is their very different backgrounds and the way they came together. They are, in this photograph, they're at a settlement house called Parkway Community House, which was directed by Caton. And Wright is a literary lion by this point. He's published his greatest work, Native Son, in 1940. It was the most commercially and critically successful work by a black fiction writer up to that point. It was a Book of the Month Club selection, a roaring bestseller, well received by critics, one of whom said a few years later, "This book has changed the face of American letters." Now, I jump back to when they first met in the mid-30s. This is a section called A Poetic Little Negro, which is the way Caton remembered the young Wright after his death. At their first encounter in the Halcyon Sanctuary behind university walls, each man was acutely aware of the different world from which the other had come. The Mississippian, that's right, stood 5'8.5" in height, had a 9th grade education, was malnourished and on relief. Knocking at the office door of sociologist Lewis Wirth, he was perhaps startled when another African-American greeted him. "Hello, what do you want?" asked the tall, barrel-chested, copper-colored man from Seattle, Washington, who felt rather superior in his status as doctoral candidate and research assistant to the eminent Professor Wirth. Born in 1903, Horace Caton Jr. was the son and namesake of a pioneering newspaper editor and leader in the Washington State Republican Party. His maternal grandfather was Hiram Revels, the first black U.S. senator and founder of Mississippi's Alcorn University. Caton's earliest years were spent in a stately two-story home with carriage house, horse and buggy, and Japanese servant. Horace and his 4 siblings went to school each day with the parental injunction, "Go out and achieve." Living among whites in the city's most affluent neighborhood, at a time when Seattle's African-American population was tiny and the residential color line had not yet been drawn, they were frequently reminded by their father that colored society starts with us. Horace began graduate work in sociology at the University of Washington with R.D. McKenzie, a former student of the eminent Professor Robert Park, but he transferred to the University of Chicago in 1931 at Park's invitation. 4 years earlier, Richard Wright had disembarked at the Illinois Central Railroad's 12th Street Station, the Ellis Island of the Chicago-bound Southern migration. No one had invited him. But 19 years of desperate, driven wandering across the Mississippi Delta had infected him with a bad case of Northern fever. He was born in 1908 in a log cabin on the old Rucker plantation 22 miles east of Natchez. Too far back in the woods to hear the train whistle, he later recalled. He was four when his father, Nathan Wright, an illiterate sharecropper, abandoned him, his mother, and younger brother, Leon. Ella Wright had been a school teacher before the marriage, but worked as a cook after her husband left. Crippling illness soon prevented her doing work of any sort and pushed her sons and her to the brink of starvation. Anxiously, they depended on other family members, moving from household to household and town to town. So these gentlemen, Horace Caton and Richard Wright, come from the exact far opposites of the spectrum of black life in the United States. But they meet in Chicago, initially in the mid-30s, and here in the early 40s, after one is established as head of a settlement house, closing in, although he never finished his PhD, he was closing in on it, and Wright as the preeminent black writer of his age. Wright was largely self-taught. And in this photograph, he's moved to New York in 1937, come back to Chicago, which is essentially the source of his inspiration, the Mississippi Delta and Chicago. Those are the poles of Richard Wright's literary imagination. They're looking at a census map of the South Side, and he's basically asked Horace Caton to provide a crash course in sociology. The sociology of the day, the theory of urbanization and the transformation of southern peasants into urban dwellers, a painful, uneasy process. And he's writing his third book, which was a photo documentary book. You may be familiar with books like the famous Walker Evans, James Agee collection, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. Most of the text is photograph with brief poetic passages. Well, that's what Richard Wright was producing here. And because his art, his literary art, was in many ways social, sociological, and documentary. Because he wanted to protest the conditions of black life, he had to represent them. And let me just take you for a moment to a discussion of Bronzeville aesthetics, the sort of art that these writers, visual artists were producing. I'm focusing on something I call the iconography of the kitchenette. Icons, of course, are images. Iconography is a pattern of images. You see similar images over and over again. And one of the things I noticed as I was reading and researching was how often the kitchenette, and I'll explain what that is in a second, how often the kitchenette appears in poems, plays, short stories, novels, photographs, paintings. Now, when we New Yorkers in the 21st century hear kitchenette, we think of a studio apartment, right? It's probably pretty small, but it's probably pretty nice. In the South Side of Chicago, this is what a kitchenette was. Picture a row house. It might be wooden, it might be brick. Picture a floor through, perhaps five rooms. That floor through flat once housed a white immigrant family. Five rooms, a bathroom in the hall. Come the Depression, come the creation of a solidly black and rather poor South Side, landlords took each of those floor-through apartments and sliced them up. They put a kerosene heater, kerosene stove in each room, called it a kitchenette flat. Every unit, sometimes mostly they were one room, occasionally two rooms. That was a large unit. They shared a common hallway bathroom. They were hellholes, filthy, vermin-ridden, and that was the kitchenette. The kitchenette appears over and over in the work of these artists because, unlike Langston Hughes, for example, who's celebrating the blues musician in the cabaret, the nightclub, the rent party, they're looking at conditions that they're protesting against. Here, for example, is what we can assume is a recently arrived family from the South, rather large family, in a kitchenette. This photograph appears in Wright's book, 12 Million Black Voices, published 1941. The photograph was taken by a photographer named Russell Lee, who worked for the Farm Security Administration. That is to say, he was a colleague of Dorothea Lange's Walker Evans. Simply to document conditions like these were to protest them, and Wright wanted to protest them. Here's another piece of visual art by a contemporary, a man named Charles White. I'll just show you the cover of the Muse in Bronzeville. This is a mural by Charles White called Five Great American Negroes. It's down at Howard University. This was a painting, a watercolor, that he rendered in 1939 while he worked for the Federal Art Project in Chicago. It's called Kitchenette Debutantes. I'm going to read you a little bit about what I wrote in the book about Kitchenette Debutantes. And I will say that it begins with a sort of formal analysis of what's going on in the painting and then connects it with some of the larger social themes. And one of my personal pleasures in writing this book was learning very slowly and gradually how to say something intelligent about a work of visual art, because my training is in literature. One of my mentors is Claudia Cardoso-Jacques, sitting in the audience, my partner, who teaches art at Westchester Community College. We looked, for example, at Kitchenette Debutantes, and we talked about it. What goes on there? And this is the results. Skillful use of light and shadow, perspective and color, draw the eye to the foregrounded figure at the window, and then back into the room to a second female figure. Sinuous lines and swirling background colors define the human element against the rectangular frame. The bitter irony of the title was immediately apparent on the south side, where tens of thousands of the poorest residents were crowded into dilapidated kitchenette buildings. White's Kitchenette Debutantes may preen in the mirror or await a caller, but clearly no cotillions or formal gowns lie in their futures. A message underscored by their clothing and the coarse, oversized hand holding a cigarette. Their lives are as tightly bounded as the window that frames their figures, and as drearily predictable as the wall of bricks beneath. White's, that is Charles White's, symbolic use of the kitchenette to evoke the harsh conditions of urban working class life exemplifies an important element in the iconography of social realism in Bronzeville. If the literary and visual art of the Harlem Renaissance frequently centered on the cabaret or house rent party, the art of Bronzeville often emphasized images of entrapment and deprivation. In 12 Million Black Voices, Richard Wright wrote, quote, "The kitchenette is our prison. The kitchenette throws desperate and unhappy people into an unbearable closeness of association. The kitchenette is the funnel through which our pulverized lives flow to ruin and death on the city pavements at a profit." So the kitchenette looms large in the literature, a literature of racial indignation and protest. Not all the artists lived in such abysmal conditions, but the sight, the theme, fed their imaginations and fed their art. Now, let me take you to another, let's call it, piece of kitchenette art. This is from Gwendolyn Brooks' first book, A Street in Bronzeville. I'm going to suggest, remember before I suggested that Brooks was following a somewhat different path, more engagement with the language itself as opposed to its propagandistic political value. And I think a poem like this, while it takes the same theme, the same site, the kitchenette, there's some new elements, new tones, and perhaps we can discuss this in a few minutes. But let me play her reading, her wonderful reading of her own work. Let's see. The art is finding the cursor. Here we are.
We are things of dry hours and the involuntary plan. Grayed in and gray. Dream makes a giddy sound, not strong like rent, feeding a wife, satisfying a man. But could a dream send up through onion fumes its white and violet, fight with fried potatoes and yesterday's garbage ripening in the hall, flutter or sing an aria down these rooms? Even if we were willing to let it in, had time to warm it, keep it very clean, anticipate a message, let it begin. We wonder, but not well, not for a minute. Since number 5 is out of the bathroom now, we think of lukewarm water, hope to get in it.
This takes a sight, this poem takes a sight of protest, the kitchenette building, yet comes from a rather different angle. There's a different tone here. I won't unpack it for you like an English professor in front of a class, but just think about what might be new and different here. I'll suggest that Gwendolyn Brooks, who continued to publish books of poetry into the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, was at the cutting edge of a new and more modern African-American writing. In her age, it was associated with other poets, particularly Robert Hayden, who may be a familiar name. In fiction, the preeminent figure who pushes the literature forward is the novelist Ralph Ellison and his masterwork, Invisible Man. But that's the cutting edge, moving from the 40s to 50s. I discuss it in the final chapter, which is called The Wheel Turns, shifting away from a protest literature that was created under conditions of the Depression. Let me just share one more example of what I'll call kitchenette art. This is the film version of Richard Wright's Native Son. There's a very interesting story behind it. He was living in Paris in the late 40s. He wanted to bring his great novel to the screen. He collaborated with a French filmmaker. They got money from the Argentine government, the government of Juan Perón, the dictator, who basically wanted to improve Argentina's international image. And the resulting product was this film of Native Son, which is quite an interesting piece. I'll just say this. I'll play the first 3 minutes, the opening of the film. The exterior scenes, which begin in the loop, the beauties of downtown Chicago, right on Lake Michigan, and then proceed into the South Side. All of those exterior scenes were shot in Chicago in the late 40s. So you'll get a sense of the the toniest, grandest landscape of the loop and some of the poorer areas of the South Side. The interiors were actually shot in Buenos Aires in studios. As you'll see, Bigger Thomas, the protagonist, grew up in a kitchenette. So, and one other point, Richard Wright plays Bigger Thomas, which is interesting because Richard Wright was then 40 years old, playing a 20-year-old figure. So we can see how well he does in the role. Oops, or not. Okay. Down?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't see the cursor.
Above the V.
Above the V. Yes, I cannot see the cursor for the life of me. Claudia, could you help me? I need someone with younger eyes here.
Chicago, the city poets have sung about. Carl Sandburg called it Hog Butcher for the World, Toolmaker. stacker of wheat, player with railroads and the nation's freight handler, stormy, husky, brawling, city of the big shoulders. Her tall skyscrapers make her a jewel among the cities of the earth. Her long, straight boulevards throb with life and vitality. Her gorgeous monuments and splashing fountains make her the envy of the world. But, like all great cities, Chicago has its secrets which are seldom written or sung. Behind her bold lines of beauty lies a hidden world. Here is Chicago's Black Belt, a prison without bars. Here, behind an invisible color line, live almost a half a million black people. These people have been told that they must live here, and the kind of work that they do is marked out for them. See those houses? A generation ago, whites used to inhabit them, but now they're crowded with black people. That house you see is the home of the Thomas family. Here is Hannah, the mother of Bigger Thomas. Let us follow her into her one-room kitchenette, where she lives with her three children. Here is Vera, Bigger's sister. And that boy is Buddy, Bigger's brother. He is hunting for one of the rats that infest this tenement. And here is Bigger himself, reading and dreaming about machines and planes. He wanted to be an explorer, a flyer, all the things a young man wants to do. But he's black. And when you're black, it's better to keep your dreams locked in your heart. He has already been forced into the path of violent rebellion against his lot in life. Here is the portrait of Bigger's father, who was lynched in the South 12 years ago. The family fled to Chicago. And since then, Hannah has struggled against great odds to raise her children. Oh, there's the rat that Buddy was looking for.
The rat again.
Oh, Lord.
I'm scared. I'm scared.
Don't let him bite you, Buddy.
I'm scared.
I'll get him this time.
There he goes. There he goes.
Buddy, shut the door. Won't let him out.
Kill him. Kill him.
Hey.
So if you've read Native Son, you know that in that opening chapter, there are really two protagonists. One is Bigger Thomas, and the other is the rat, who represents everything ugly and violent and dangerous about ghetto life. So I'll put a check there and simply suggest that Native Son, both the film and the novel, represent, encapsulate the achievements of the Black Chicago Renaissance in rendering conditions of life that were unbearable, conditions of life that, in the very documenting of them, began to protest against them and to energize the reader, the audience. And that was largely the story of the Black Chicago Renaissance, creating an art of enormous human power by focusing on subjects and scenes that had not been particularly explored in American literature up to that point. And if you want to know more about the story of the Black Chicago Renaissance, it's available in the Muse in Bronzeville. Thank you for coming this evening. And I'm wondering if there are any questions. Or, yes, please.
How much of the difference that you describe between the Harlem Renaissance and the Chicago Renaissance do you think is attributable to sociological, in other words, differences in the two communities, but how much is attributable to the fact that it was the depressions, you know, and
yes,
what that meant? And so you're talking about, you know, a flourishing in the 20s, forget where it was, you know, I'm flourishing in the 30s and 40s.
The depression has to be accounted as a factor of overwhelming importance. Some of these artists were people who in the depression were called the new poor. And this is kind of sadly familiar these days, but people who had been middle class black folks who were impoverished, whose hopes seemed to be destroyed. So the Depression itself and the conditions created by the Depression fueled this anger. The 1920s, all things being relative, were a relatively prosperous time for what was a growing educated black middle class, and they had brighter hopes. They also had something of a publicity machine in New York City associated with the two civil rights journals, The Crisis, produced by the NAACP, and Opportunity, produced by the Urban League. Harlem's Renaissance, the historians tell us, was more a, one says, a forced phenomenon. It was made. Civil rights leaders were frustrated in many areas, but they thought that perhaps if black writers and artists could demonstrate the excellence of their talents, they might make inroads in a very difficult situation. The black Chicago Renaissance sort of happened. Chicago was the preeminent destination for southern migration from the Mississippi Delta, the old black belt of the South, Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi. And some few of those migrants had hopes of artistic careers, and they found one another. And they improvised institutions, and the Roosevelt administration, the New Deal, created the Federal Writers Project, the Federal Art Project, under conditions of the Depression, to put writers and artists to work. So yes, the Depression has to be accounted as overwhelmingly important, and one, I would factor in certain conditions of Chicago, its physical location in relation to the Deep South, and its industrial nature. A lot of these folks' parents worked in the stockyards, okay? They may have even worked in the stockyards themselves, because Chicago, after all, as Carl Sandburg tells us, was hog butcher to the world, city of the big shoulders. It was an industrial working class town, and that gave its art a certain character as well. Thank you for the question. Anyone else? Sir.
So just an interesting aside, kitchenette apartments. I was subject to kitchenette apartments. In my early years, mm-hmm. I was from first Port, Connecticut to downtown New York City, Avenue A and Grove Street. And they had a kitchenette apartment that my brother and I did. And it wasn't pretty. It wasn't pretty even then, which is, I don't know, like 40 years, 50 years now. And I never forget going to sleep and then getting up to go to the bathroom, mm-hmm. put the light on, and it wasn't a rat, but it was a mouse at the border. The gas lights were, mm-hmm. and the mouse was there going like that.
Right.
And I said to myself, you poor bastard, I says, you're cold, didn't I? So I'm quite recognizing kitchenettes.
And when artists turn their attention to a scene like that, there's a real human power in it. Yeah. Thank you. I think we should be wrapping up.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you.
Come to Zero Waste Day, Saturday, April 20th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at North Castle Town Hall. We are accepting spring and summer clothing, bikes, scrap metals and oils. Paper shredding will be available. E-waste, supplies for dogs and cats, and household furniture. Go to northcastleny.com for more information. Zero Waste Day, Saturday, April 20th, from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at North Castle Town Hall.